This summer, I am taking the opportunity to preach some sermons from Westmoreland's past, a series of sermons about war and peace. As I've said, this is part of my doctoral program, and so I'm asking for your input. I'm asking for your insight. If you would take the opportunity after the service to fill out the surveys that are in your order of service or to do that online via the email we send out every Monday, I would appreciate that. So I invite you to hear this sermon with that in mind. And I also ask you to listen to how this speaks to your soul and to the world on this day. The sermon was preached on Memorial Day Sunday in 1953 by the Reverend Phil Scott. We hear his words. Twice, we are told, tears came to the eyes of Jesus. Once he wept when a friend had come close to death, and when he saw Jerusalem, tears started again. He loved his land, his people, but these were not the tears that come to our eyes when some patriotic feeling moves us. These tears rose from the mocking contradiction of the city's name. If we spoke Bible languages, we would know that every time people said Jerusalem, they were saying the possession of peace. Here is where we shall find peace. That is what the name of the city means. Jesus had only to speak that name, the capital, the holy city, the symbol of his people's hope, and have his heart break. Peace, they called it, the possession of peace. If they only knew where peace could be found, the things that make for peace. But he knew he would walk the city streets in the midst of people who could not see. From their eyes were hid the things that make for peace. It was as if you were entering our city, coming down from Wood Acres on Massachusetts Avenue. You would see the city below, and you might say, Washington, the name of this town. Then you realize the contrasts, how little some of the life of the town is like the character of and spirit of the man for whom it was named. The lies that thrive under the name of a man of honest word and integrity. The greed for glory that contradicts the quiet dignity of his service. The zeal for the quick gain that mocks the patient public service of the first citizen of the city. Peace, said Jesus as he turned toward Jerusalem. His tears were for the pathetic hope of the possession of peace in people blind to how it could be reached. People are most blind when they think they have a right to peace. If we had the mind of Christ as we look on our city, Memorial Day might have that meaning. Its more solemn celebration would not be so much for what is brought back from memory, the sadness of separations, the tragic toll of war, the costly sacrifice. It would be the contradictions that would claim our thought and the contrasts with these gifts that we recall. We celebrate Memorial Day with gratitude and guilt. We will never get over the sense of debt we have in this visible and complete offering of the people who served their country in their death. All of the dislocation of the war years might be forgotten, but these deaths are the unalterable and the unchanged. They stand as completed gifts. We are grateful and guilty. J. Robert Oppenheimer, wartime head of the Los Alamos Laboratory, spoke some time ago for some of the scientists involved in the project. He said, "The experience of the war has left us with a legacy of concern. In some sort of crude sense, which no vulgarity, no humor, no overstatement can quite extinguish, the physicists have known sin. And this is a knowledge they cannot lose. We are guilty. Everyone has, in some degree, that sense of sin. Some have survivor's guilt. Others have the sense that something they should have done or could have done was not done. We are grateful and guilty. Do we have the right to peace? Grateful and guilty. In her novel, Song in the Night, Josephine Lawrence translates into fiction the problem of all of us. How can I work toward peace? In the opening pages, Lisa Miller is waiting for Mass to begin on Christmas Eve, 1950. She finds prayer difficult because of bitterness over the death of a son in World War II. In the dim church, she makes a solemn vow. There is nothing, God, that I will not do to contribute toward peace. But what can she do? As if in direct answer to her prayer and to her question, come the words of the priest. As long as there is one hate, one single misunderstanding or resentment in your heart, you have no right to pray for peace. That was an entirely new thought for Lisa. She began to examine herself, her family, the people she came in contact with. In the end of the story, the potential for peace is heightened in that circle, in the circle of her own family and contacts. Because of the spread of individual tolerance and the genuine fulfillment of love between persons, Lisa's life and the lives of many she can influence are dedicated to the priest's insistence that as we fail in our own small lives to demonstrate the power of understanding, we become the weakest link in a chain that must be unbreakable. The focus here is on an area that seems far too small. The solution is far too simple for the problem of peace, which is the deepest and largest of our difficulties. But she earned the right to peace and to work for peace and discovered a way of life that could redeem the loss of her son. But this is the real battleground, the area of 100 yards to the right or left, what we need most to establish our right to peace. President Eisenhower emphasized that our right to peace is conditioned by our ability and willingness to work with other nations. And not, as had been said, forget the United Nations as far as the Korean War is concerned. Our whole policy, President Eisenhower said, is based on this theory. No single free nation can live alone in the world. We have got to have friends. We have to have that unity in basic purposes that comes from a recognition of common interests. Our right to peace? We have no right to peace unless we see the things that belong to peace. Weakness cannot cooperate with anything, says President Eisenhower. We shall have to be strong. The political maturity demanded may be beyond us unless we change some of the things we see in our divisions at home. But the right to peace will lie not only in our national strength, our willingness to stand alone. The right to peace will lie in our own knowledge of the things that belong to peace, that are the strength of our own lives for the long years to come. So I'm grateful to Phil Scott and his ministry here, the words he spoke in 1953. May they speak to us on this day.